Experts estimate that American doctors make 12 million diagnostic errors every year. What are the most common mistakes? This is the People's Pharmacy with Terry and Joe Graydon.
Diagnostic errors may be one of the leading causes of death in the U.S., though you won't find it on a death certificate. A new study has identified the most common conditions in which misdiagnosis leads to malpractice claims. Dr. David Newman-Toker is one of the world's leading experts on the mistakes doctors make in diagnosis. Find out about his research.
How can you protect yourself or your loved ones from a diagnostic error? Dr. Newman-Toker suggests some critical questions to ask about what could be causing your symptoms.
Coming up on The People's Pharmacy, what happens when doctors make diagnostic mistakes? In The People's Pharmacy Health Headlines, postmenopausal women are at risk for bone fractures, in part due to the wide prevalence of osteoporosis. Researchers writing in the journal JAMA Network Open suggest that lack of physical activity may also contribute to this risk. They followed the 77,206 participants of the Women's Health Initiative for an average of 20 years. Women who were more active were significantly less likely to break a hip. The volunteers didn't have to be doing anything heroic. Just walking regularly or doing yard work was also linked to a lower risk of hip fracture. Women who participated regularly in vigorous activities such as aerobics dancing or tennis were more likely to break a wrist or forearm. The researchers note that such activity, except for tennis, may not do much to strengthen wrist or arm bones. Even mild activity lowered women's chance of a vertebral fracture. Sedentary time of more than 9.5 hours a day, on the other hand, was linked to a higher total fracture risk. The message for women as we grow older, keep moving.
When people are diagnosed with cancer, they're often faced with challenging treatment decisions. Surgery, radiation, chemotherapy, or more recently, pricey immunotherapy. Now, researchers are suggesting an additional approach. Exercise. They're moving through cancer guidelines were published in the journal CA, a cancer journal for clinicians. The article was titled, Exercise is Medicine in Oncology, Engaging Clinicians to Help Patients Move Through Cancer. The authors note that exercise during treatment for melanoma, as well as prostate, breast, and colon cancer, can be helpful for easing symptoms of anxiety and depression. Even more important, exercise may enhance treatment and improve survival statistics. Perhaps it's time for oncologists and cancer centers to integrate exercise plans into their treatment programs. The authors of the Exercise is Medicine report conclude that current practice is failing those diagnosed with cancer. They encourage the full development of an exercise oncology workforce. Their call to action urges cancer clinicians, researchers, policymakers, patients, and the healthcare industry to transform health and well-being from cancer diagnosis through treatment and for the balance of life.
Vincristine is an old drug that's a pillar of cancer treatment, especially for children. It's essential for treating cancers like lymphoma, leukemia, and brain tumors. Unfortunately, there's currently a severe shortage of this medicine. There are no good substitutes, so oncologists are facing the prospect of having to ration the drug or not being able to treat some patients. In June of this year, the drug firm Teva made a business decision to discontinue the product. That left a single supplier, Pfizer, which has had manufacturing difficulties. According to the FDA, Pfizer has experienced a delay, and we are working closely with them in exploring all options to make sure this critical cancer drug is available for the patients who need it. That can't come too soon for the 19,000 pediatric cancer patients every year.
Scientists now believe they have identified the cause of acute flaccid myelitis, abbreviated AFM. This polio-like illness has affected around 600 children since it was first detected almost a decade ago. A number have been paralyzed, just like the children affected by polio. A large number of cases appeared in 2014, 2016, and 2018. As soon as these cases began appearing, scientists tried to figure out the cause. They ruled out poliovirus very quickly. A new study has identified some type of enterovirus. Usually, these common viruses cause mild illness with cold-like symptoms. The viruses aren't easily identified after causing infection, so the researchers used a tool called VerScan to identify antibodies. Around 70% of the AFM patients have antibodies to enteroviruses in their cerebrospinal fluid, compared to just 7% of kids with other neurological diseases. At this point, the most likely candidate is EVD68. Hopefully, a vaccine will be developed in the near future to prevent this devastating condition. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.
Welcome to the People's Pharmacy. I'm Terry Graydon.
And I'm Joe Graydon. When you get sick, you need a diagnosis. If the diagnosis is wrong, the treatment won't be appropriate. You may get the wrong medicine or even a surgery you don't need. The delay in diagnosis may lead to more severe illness. Diagnostic errors are a lot more common than you might imagine. They're a leading cause of preventable deaths.
How has the medical profession addressed this serious problem? Is there any way to protect yourself from diagnostic mistakes? What information does your doctor need? And what questions should you be asking to help get the diagnosis right?
To help us answer these critical questions, we turn to Dr. David Newman Toker. He's director of the Johns Hopkins Armstrong Institute Center for Diagnostic Excellence and director of the Division of Neurovisual and Vestibular Disorders in the Department of Neurology. He's also professor of neurology at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He's a leader in the Society to Improve Diagnosis in Medicine.
Welcome back to the People's Pharmacy, Dr. David Newman Toker.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Dr. Newman Toker, you have written about misdiagnosis before, but your most recent research is just breathtaking. What stimulated your curiosity to do this kind of what we'll call malpractice type investigation?
Well, thanks very much for covering this topic, Joe and Terry. It's a critically important public health issue. Diagnostic errors, one that we've had a chance to talk about in the past. This is an important study that we recently published. It's part actually of a larger study that's ongoing that relates to trying to define how frequently patients are harmed by diagnostic error. And it turns out that even though we know diagnostic errors are a big problem, we don't actually know the full magnitude of the problem because we don't have any systematic methods for tracking the numbers of diagnostic errors that are out there.
Why not?
It's a good question. So part of it is that they're difficult to measure. So diagnostic errors in general are harder to measure than other errors because we don't find out until later that they've happened. So if, for example, we have a medication dosing error, we usually find out about it right away. Somebody gets 10 times the dose of a chemotherapy agent than they're supposed to. They have toxic side effects right away. Everybody figures out what happened very quickly. They know where it happened, when it happened, how it happened. Same for things like wrong site surgery, et cetera. So those are errors that are obvious and transparent. Diagnostic errors tend to be discovered retrospectively. So what happens is we miss a diagnosis. We don't know we've missed it, but then something happens to the patient days, weeks, or months later that may or may not be recognized as a missed opportunity that happened earlier to make the diagnosis sooner and potentially give the patient the right treatment. So there isn't a structure right now in medicine to keep track of that. And you add to that the fact that people are always concerned about hindsight bias and hindsight being 20/20. You always run into these questions of, well, even if it was a misdiagnosis, could it have been made? Could it not have been made? Was it preventable? What could have happened? And that has kind of prevented us from getting aggregate numbers of how many people actually suffer a misdiagnosis and how many people are actually harmed.
And just to make things a little more complicated, the person who missed that diagnosis, the clinician, may never find out that he or she didn't make the right diagnosis, right?
Yeah. In fact, it's quite frequent that clinicians never get that feedback at all. There's a saying that diagnostic errors are like bad breath. You know about everybody else's, but not your own.
Right.
So as physicians, this has actually been studied. Surveys of physicians, they ask physicians, how often do you see diagnostic errors in your clinical practice? And they say something on the order of magnitude of once a week to once a month. And then they're asked, when was the last one you made? And the answer is, I can't remember the last time I made a diagnostic error. Typically, maybe one sometime in the last 5 or 10 years. So everyone is basically above average. It's like woebegone.
Okay. How many diagnostic errors are there in this country each year? How many lead to harm? How many lead to death? And I recognize that's a much more complicated question than it may seem, because as you point out, there is no systematic way of actually recording these kinds of problems.
That's right. So I'll give you the best estimates that we have today, some of them based on prior work, some of them based on the work that we're discussing today from the malpractice claims data. On the total number of diagnostic errors in the United States of America, the main estimate that's been put out there is about 12 million. Based upon estimates from a couple of reasonably well-done studies in primary care settings by Hardeep Singh and colleagues. And those estimates really only reflect the errors that people were able to detect in those primary care clinics. We don't know if the number is actually much higher than that, but it would not be surprising if out of the billion or so healthcare encounters, most of which are in the ambulatory care setting, that 12 million were associated with diagnostic errors. Some estimates have suggested the number might be much higher than that, on the order of magnitude of 10 or 15% of all encounters for which there's a diagnosis under consideration. And that might be a number even, you know, closer to 50 to 100 million. But it's a big number of people who suffer diagnostic errors. How many of those result in harm has been a much trickier question to get at, and that's part of what we were after in this study. We know from autopsy-based studies that in the hospital alone, if we look at deaths, about 5 to 10% of deaths are associated with diagnostic errors, and diagnostic errors that we think could have ultimately been linked to those deaths. From that, we can estimate approximately 40 to 80,000 people die in U.S. hospitals each year as a result of diagnostic errors that could, would, or should have been prevented. We also know from malpractice claims, both in a prior study that we did using national malpractice claims and the current study that we did using a subset of those claims where we had more data about each of the claims, those we know that about half of the serious harms from diagnostic errors result in death, and about half result in serious disability. And so in total, we can estimate, well, maybe there's somewhere between 80 and 160,000 patients who suffer serious harms, either permanent disability or death, from diagnostic errors. But that's probably a conservative estimate. We don't have the final numbers yet, but our best guess is that probably the final number is somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million patients a year suffering death or permanent disability, about 50-50 split between the two.
Yikes. I mean, that makes diagnostic errors one of the leading causes of death in this country and maybe worldwide.
It's quite possible that that's true. It's obviously a little tricky to frame it that way simply because the diseases themselves are already being counted in some of the other lists, you know, heart disease causing death and cancer causing death and infection causing death are part of those statistics. So they're not directly comparing apples to apples, but numerically, that's right. It is quite possible that diagnostic errors are, if not the leading cause of death and permanent disability in the United States and potentially the world, certainly one of the leading causes.
Dr. Niemann-Toker, you looked at malpractice claims to figure out something about diagnostic errors. So can you summarize for us, please, what you learned in this study?
Sure. So I'll start with a brief description of what we did in this study. We worked with our partners at CRICO Strategies with their national CRICO benchmarking system claims database. Our lead investigator there was Dana Siegel, and we had an excellent team of collaborators there working with our team at Johns Hopkins. And they have access to about a third of all the national malpractice claims. So it's a pretty representative data set. We've actually compared the two data sets, and they're almost identical on this issue of patients with serious harm, the national numbers, and this subset. We used this subset because we could drill down into the clinical details, which you're not allowed to do with the national numbers. So we took this subset of data, and we divided it up according to clinically sensible categories. We used a mapping method that's a little technical, but the bottom line is it puts all of the diagnosis codes into clinically sensible categories, things that are familiar to people: cancers, infections, vascular events, congenital malformations, et cetera. There are about 10 or 15 big bucket categories, but we looked at three in particular that we knew from prior studies probably consumed a large fraction of all the serious harms from diagnostic errors. We didn't know exactly what size of a fraction, but we knew it was big. We expected it to be more than half. And what we found was that when you look at all the serious harms, and by that I mean permanent disability or death, and permanent disability being equivalent to the severity of losing a limb or an eye or worse, that about three quarters of those serious harms, permanent disability and death, were the result of diseases in one of three big categories that we call the big three: cancers, infections, and vascular events. Those three categories together made up the lion's share of the serious harms, and everything else was squeezed into the remaining roughly 25%.
You're listening to Dr. David Newman-Toker. He's director of the Johns Hopkins Armstrong Institute Center for Diagnostic Excellence and director of the Division of Neurovisual and Vestibular Disorders in the Department of Neurology. He's also a professor of neurology at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. His recent article, Serious Misdiagnosis-Related Harms in Malpractice Claims, The Big Three, Vascular Events, Infections, and Cancers, was published in the journal Diagnosis.
After the break, why hasn't technology solved the problem of misdiagnosis?
What are the main causes of diagnostic errors?
One important reason Dr. Newman-Toker and his colleagues found is errors in clinical judgment. What does that mean, and how can it be addressed?
Are there questions patients should ask to help the doctor get to the correct diagnosis?
Should misdiagnosis be listed as a cause of death? It isn't currently. And should there be an institute for preventing diagnostic errors?
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon. Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Terry Graydon.
And I'm Joe Graydon.
The People's Pharmacy is brought to you in part by Mighty Muscadine Grapeseed and Skin Products, natural supplements, juice, and snacks containing antioxidants that research indicates may support cardiovascular, immune system, and joint health. Information online, mightymuscadine.com.
And by CocoVia, the maker of high-potency cocoa flavanol supplements that support cognitive and cardiovascular health. More information at CocoVia, that's CocoVia.com.
Also by Verizana, an analytical laboratory providing home health tests for hormones, gut health, and the microbiome. Online at verizana.com.
Today we are discussing diagnostic errors and how to prevent them.
Our guest is Dr. David Newman-Toker. He's director of the Johns Hopkins Armstrong Institute Center for Diagnostic Excellence and director of the Division of Neurovisual and Vestibular Disorders in the Department of Neurology. He's also a professor of neurology at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine.
Dr. Newman-Toker, I have to be honest, I'm really shocked. I'm shocked that there are so many diagnostic errors, especially because every medical student, every doctor is trained pretty thoroughly in these particular areas like stroke, heart attack, infections, and cancer detection. And you mentioned a little earlier that 10 to 15% of all the harms and deaths may be due to diagnostic error. And we've actually done a bit of research on our own. And those numbers, they are on the high end, but that's basically what has been reported over the last, 50, 60, 70, 80 years. So the needle hasn't moved very much. But in the last 10 or 20 years, we have so many sophisticated tests. I mean, we have technology that didn't exist 50, 60 years ago. We've got MRIs. We've got CT scans. We've got blood tests that detect heart attacks. I mean, we have technology. Why aren't we doing better?
Well, you know, the simple answer to that question, Joe, is that diagnosis is hard, right? It's complicated. It's difficult. Patients present with unusual or atypical symptoms on a regular basis that are not classic things that people are taught in medical school. So, you know, unpacking this is pretty challenging overall, and trying to fix it is pretty challenging. Let me just sort of touch on a couple of points that you made. This issue of sort of trends in diagnostic errors over time. Probably the best data we have on the issue of trends in diagnostic error rates over time are from autopsy studies. There was a wonderful study done by Kaveh Shahjani and colleagues, which was published in JAMA almost 15 plus years ago, that looked at autopsies over the last several decades. And they compared the rates of diagnostic error, what they call class one diagnostic errors, that is, errors that could, would, or should have led to not only a change in management, but a change in outcome for the patient. That is, they may have left the hospital alive rather than dead. And they found that there was actually a slight downward trend in the fraction of autopsies, even accounting for all the shifts and changes in how often we do autopsies, adjusting for all of those factors, that there was a slow, steady decline in the fraction of deaths in hospitals that were due to diagnostic errors. And in the modern era, it was closer to 5%, and before that, it was closer to 10%. So I think it's probably not true that we haven't made any progress. I think we have, but it's been slow and it's been painstaking. And a large part of that at some sort of global level is that we have not paid enough attention to this problem. We have not addressed this issue at a healthcare system level. So, for example, our entire health system, all the way from training of physicians through to clinical practice and even research about medicine, are mostly structured around organ systems and diseases and treatments rather than around symptoms and diagnosis. And that's a critical framing problem that at a broad level is probably responsible for why we've made less progress than we should have at this point. I'll give you a specific example. So, for example, in medical school, you may, as a medical student, see a case given to you during the heart block, the cardiology block that you're taught about that has a patient with chest pain. What are the chances that that patient is going to turn out to have a gastroesophageal reflux rather than a heart problem?
Well, if you're studying heart problems, it's pretty low.
Exactly. That's right. It's diagnosis by curriculum. And unfortunately, our entire educational system is kind of built that way. And then it's perpetuated during training, where we train on an organ system basis. I'm a neurologist. That means I deal with diseases of the nervous system. Somebody else is a pulmonologist. They deal with diseases of the lungs. But nobody is out there saying, well, look, if a patient has dizziness, and some of it, the patients might have a neurologic problem, and some of them might have an ear problem, and some of them might have a lung problem, and we don't know which of those is causing it, the opportunities to train and learn in that way actually are lacking. So we have some serious deficits there. And on the research side, we took our research, the research that I've focused on over the years is about diagnosis of stroke in patients with dizziness and vertigo. And we took that problem to the National Institutes of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, and they said, well, you know, we're interested in stroke, but only a small percentage of the dizzy patients have stroke, so you should talk to the ear people. Maybe talk to the ear people. And they said, well, a lot of the patients with dizziness have ear problems, but the only reason why it matters to make the diagnosis urgently in the emergency room is because the patients have stroke, so you should go talk to the stroke people.
So you went around and around
right,
in circles.
Right, exactly. And that's kind of what we've been doing in the whole field.
Dr. Newman-Toker, one of the things that you said in your study that was kind of a cause, and I think this is a, you know, really following up on what you're saying here, one of the causes of these misdiagnoses is clinical judgment, errors in clinical judgment. Can you explain to us what that means and why?
So when we talk about causes for errors in general, especially diagnostic errors, there's a tendency to divide them into two big buckets. One is called cognitive factors, sometimes also called clinical reasoning or clinical judgment, and the other is sometimes called systems factors, which tends to lump together a bunch of things that relate to failures of communication or documentation, so on and so forth, that are less related to the decision-making and thought process around diagnosis. That distinction is a little bit arbitrary because the thought process happens within a context of a healthcare system, and either there are supportive things in that system to help people with their reasoning, or there are things that hurt them, like distractions or lack of informative decision support or evidence-based resources or lack of access to tests. All of those things then impact the cognitive process, so you can't really disentangle them. But in this data set from Crico Strategies, they codified every type of cause that they found in each of the cases that we analyzed. And so there were obviously more causes than there were instances of error resulting in harm. In fact, there were about two or three times as many causes because there were an average of two or three such identified causes per case. Bar none, far and away the leading cause found was clinical judgment factors, which was present in about 85% of all cases. And that was true across all big three categories of diseases. So more than 80% of the cases had at least one failure in clinical reasoning or clinical judgment. Those things might be failure to consider a diagnosis. They might be things such as incorrect weighting of probability of one diagnosis versus another, failure to order a particular diagnostic test that was relevant. Ultimately, though, that finding is totally in keeping with almost everything that's been published in the literature previously. Although it's critically important that we do things like close the loop on test results reports. For example, it should never be the case that somebody has their cancer diagnosed correctly, but the report is faxed somewhere and then lost, and that results in harm to the patient, as has happened to some prominent patients who are part of the patient safety movement. That should never happen. But that's a relatively small fraction of the problems. The majority of them happen at the bedside in the interaction between doctor and patient, in the information gathering and processing phase. And that means that the kind of solutions that we need to bring are ones that address those bedside failures. Not saying we don't need to do the other things as well, but if we don't tackle the problems at the bedside diagnostic phase, we are not going to be able to solve the diagnostic error problem.
We often encourage people to ask their health professional one important question: doctor, what else could it be? And because sometimes there's what you all call a differential diagnosis. You know, the top three are A, B, and C. And by asking what else could it be might lead you to F or G.
I think that's right. We often see that what sometimes happens with physicians is they get locked in on either the common things or common explanation, or they sort of stop thinking when it seems to fit a certain pattern. And opening up that dialogue around what else could it be, I think, is important. I also think it's important, though, that patients specifically frame it around this question of what's the worst thing it could be. And the reason why that is, or the most common worst thing, because there's a long list of things that it could be. Usually in any given case for any given symptom, there are anywhere from 50 to 100 or more diseases on that list. But not all of them are mission critical to diagnose today. In fact, for any given common symptom, there are probably no more than 5 to 15 diseases that are responsible for serious harms if we just take a watchful waiting approach. Those are the diseases that in any given particular context, whether it's chest pain and shortness of breath, in which case, you know, the big worries are things like heart attack and venous thromboembolism. If it's dizziness, it's stroke. If it's headache, it's subarachnoid hemorrhage. Those kinds of things, those are critical things to draw out in the from the physician's discussion. And they should be able to give you a compelling reason why your headache is a migraine and not a subarachnoid hemorrhage that could kill you tomorrow. And that's really the crux of that inquiry. The patients really need to own that, hear what the physician has to say about it, and assess whether it sounds like they really know what they're talking about.
We've been talking theoretically, and I know our listeners can better understand what this is all about if we provide examples, case reports. So let me tell you about my Uncle Leo. Uncle Leo was a dairy farmer for much of his life. He was in great shape. And in his 70s, he developed prostate cancer. In his 80s, it came back. You know, he was treated initially at Stanford University, one of the great medical centers in this country. When it came back, they treated him with DES, estrogenic hormone, to suppress the cancer. And that seemed to be working. And then one day he started coughing and his lungs hurt. He went to the hospital, maybe even to the emergency room, and they basically sent him home with cough medicine. It kept getting worse. And it progressed to such a point that he had to go back to the hospital, I think, 2 or 3 times. And then they eventually figured out, you have a blood clot in your lungs, something called a pulmonary embolism. It could have killed him. It was missed the first couple of times. I suspect that that may fall under your vascular problem. And we wonder, you know, how common are these VTEs, venous thromboembolism problems, or PEs, pulmonary embolisms? And then maybe you can tell us a little bit about a case regarding stroke.
Sure. So the answer is quite common. Unfortunately, that story is a typical story. Venous thromboembolism was the number 3 vascular event in our series. It accounted for about 15% roughly of the vascular event cases. So it was a significant fraction. We know that deep vein thrombosis and venous thromboembolism is something that can kill people if we don't get there in time and treat with the appropriate drugs to either prevent clot formation or break up clots after they've occurred. So, you know, your uncle was lucky that he was one of the ones who survived the misdiagnosis. And I should, you know, we should let the audience know that it is not uniformly the case that errors with these diseases result in permanent harms. In fact, a lot of people do get lucky. And that's part of the reason why it's sort of it's hard to figure out when we should or shouldn't have missed something, because we know that some people are going to make it anyway, despite the delay in diagnosis. And that gets us into all sorts of arguments about, well, how long a delay is acceptable. But for venous thromboembolism, it turns out that as you wait longer and longer, as you go from days of delay to weeks of delay, your chances of suffering a serious harm go way up. And that's true for most diseases, and it varies based on the biology of the disease. For some diseases like cancer, it's weeks or months before the delay starts to make a difference. And for diseases like infections, it's usually days to weeks. And for diseases like vascular events, it's usually hours to days, occasionally weeks, depending on the nature of the condition. A stroke is one of the ones that we've looked at extensively. We know that the risks of a major stroke following a minor stroke are greatest in the first 72 hours after an event. And so there's a real urgency in getting the diagnosis right the first time. Addressing stroke misdiagnosis is a critical issue because if we get to people very early in the first 6 hours, we can give them clot-busting treatments. And if we get to them early in the first 1 to 2 days, we can give them preventative medicines that prevent a major stroke after a minor stroke. So doing that is mission critical. Early diagnosis is critical for stroke patients.
Should the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention list medical mistakes, harms, misdiagnosis in their leading causes of death in the United States?
I certainly think that there should be a systematic public tracking of these kinds of problems. I don't know that it needs to be on the same list as cancer and heart attack or heart disease in the sense that we're talking about the same diseases. But I do think we should have that kind of a patient safety listing, and we should be publicly tracking this information. It's going to take a little while before we have the measurement methods to do it, but I think it's an absolute necessity. And then we should be pegging commensurate funding for research and operations improvement to solve those problems.
Should there be an institute? Like, you know, there's the National Institutes of Health, and it includes things like, you know, in your area, the brain or infectious disease or cancer. Should we have an institute for preventing diagnostic errors and medical harms?
I think that would be fabulous. I don't know whether it's in the making or in the offing, but I think something devoted to either symptom-oriented diagnostic research or diagnostic safety and quality, whether that's ultimately through the umbrella of the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality that's now leading an interagency working group on that subject or some other mechanism, I do think we need some kind of governmental oversight over this problem. It is a huge public health problem that needs to be tackled.
You've been listening to Dr. David Newman Toker. He's director of the Johns Hopkins Armstrong Institute Center for Diagnostic Excellence and director of the Division of Neurovisual and Vestibular Disorders in the Department of Neurology.
After the break, we'll find out why stroke is so frequently misdiagnosed.
How can medicine reduce bedside errors?
Dr. Newman Toker will tell us about the four T's: teamwork, training, technology, and tuning. We'll also learn how patients can help.
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon. Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Terry Graydon.
And I'm Joe Graydon. The People's Pharmacy is brought to you in part by Cocovia, offering plant-based nutrients in the form of coca flavanols for brain and heart health. Online at cocovia.com.
And by Kaya Biotics, probiotic products made in Germany from certified organic ingredients. KAYABiotics.com.
Also by Mighty Muscadine Grapeseed and Skin Products, natural supplements, juice, and snacks containing antioxidants that research indicates may support cardiovascular, immune system, and joint health. Information online at mightymuscadine.com.
We're talking today about why misdiagnoses are a leading cause of death in the United States. What can you do to protect yourself and those you love?
Our guest, Dr. David Newman Toker, is director of the Johns Hopkins Armstrong Institute Center for Diagnostic Excellence and director of the Division of Neurovisual and Vestibular Disorders in the Department of Neurology. He's also professor of neurology at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine.
Dr. Newman Toker, in the study, you and your colleagues found that stroke was frequently misdiagnosed in the vascular events category. Can you tell us about a time when stroke was misdiagnosed, a story?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I'm actually going to share the story of John Michael Knight, who he and his family have agreed to allow me to tell this story publicly because they want to make sure that what happened to him doesn't happen to anybody else. John Michael Knight, a few years ago, was a championship-level high school lacrosse player. He was going to college on a full athletic and academic scholarship, and he was playing in his last lacrosse high school game. They won. It was great, but And the next day or two, he started to feel sick. He got dizzy, got vertigo, nausea, a little bit unsteady on his feet. And his parents took him to the emergency department. And first thing the emergency department folks did was they focused around, you know, what he was drinking or smoking, because a lot of young people, that's a cause of these kinds of symptoms. It's not infrequent. He insisted he hadn't done any of that. His parents insisted that he was a good kid and he hadn't done any of that. They seemed focused on that for a while. Then when all the screens came back negative, they said, oh, well, it's probably an ear problem. Let's send you home with these medications to treat your symptoms, but not the underlying disease, because there isn't a specific treatment for this kind of ear problem, is sort of how it was framed. Shortly before he was signing the discharge paperwork to leave, he started to deteriorate and to look worse. And so his parents convinced them to admit him to the hospital. Unfortunately, they didn't really figure out what was going on for about 2 to 3 days. And by that time, what was actually happening, which was that he was having an early minor stroke that was evolving into a major stroke, by the end of those 3 days, he was in a state that we call locked in. He was quadriplegic and mute and only able to communicate by blinking his eyelids and moving his eyes in response to questions, sort of a yes-no pattern. This is a tragic state. Obviously, it's a tragedy for him personally, for his family. It's also a tragedy for the healthcare system. Whether you look at it through the lens of harm to an individual and at a population level, many, many patients, or whether you look at it through the lens of healthcare costs, here's a real inefficiency where we failed to capitalize on an opportunity to treat something early and instead are left dealing with the consequences of it late. His lifetime cost of care, he needs full-time care. He's recovered to the point where he can operate a motorized wheelchair by tipping his head, but he still can't speak. He still can't move his limbs. So his lifetime costs of care are enormous. So if we think a little bit about investing in improving this problem, we'll get a return on investment pretty quickly with cases like this. This may sound like an extreme case or a rare case, and to some extent it is, in the sense that this particular sort of tragic endpoint state of being locked in is not always the common endpoint. But it's not that much worse than being in a nursing home or dying. And in terms of the frequency of this, we believe our estimates show that about 50 to 75,000 people a year have their strokes missed when they come to an acute care setting like the emergency department or occasionally a primary care clinic with dizziness or vertigo as their primary symptoms. And there's a reason for that. Strokes most often present with symptoms that are more obvious to patients, things like weakness on one side of the body or inability to talk. And those stroke symptoms are pretty well recognized both by patients and by physicians. It's when strokes present with atypical symptoms, such as dizziness or that looks like an ear infection or headaches that look like a migraine, things that are more common, that's when we tend to miss them. And that makes sense. That's true actually across all diseases. The atypical nature of the presentation is the most common clinical risk factor for somebody having their diagnosis missed, and it increases the odds of being missed anywhere from 5 to 50-fold, depending on how atypical the presentation is. So that's what happened. It also was an abnormal context because it was a young person having stroke. We know that young patients are about 7 times more likely to have their strokes missed when they do have strokes. They're much less likely to have strokes in the first place than older patients, but much more likely to be misdiagnosed when they have them. It's sort of out of sight and out of mind. So John Michael Knight had sort of the double whammy of an atypical stroke presentation in a young patient, and that is the real killer. We believe there are somewhere between 10 and 25,000 patients a year in the U.S. who suffer death or permanent disability specifically with the kind of clinical presentation that John Michael Knight had.
Well, Dr. Newman-Tucker, let me ask you to kind of expand on how can medicine tackle these errors and reduce them?
Yeah, so I think this is a critical question. It's obviously the one that's on the minds of a lot of people now that we're sort of shining a brighter light on the burden and severity of this problem for so many Americans and so many people around the world. I will say that solving the problem in the broadest sense will require a multi-pronged strategy that involves stakeholders from around the country. And as part of some of the national work that we're doing with the Society to Improve Diagnosis in Medicine, we are trying to move the needle on diagnostic error by really changing the conversation and pushing for more funding for research, better payment models that force us to do diagnosis better and be rewarded for doing diagnosis better, so on and so forth. Those kinds of war room, large-scale strategies are things that are ongoing at a national level, and that's a critical piece of this movement, part of which is sort of raising public awareness. At the micro level, when we start getting down to the individual hospitals and providers, I talk about there being sort of four T's to transform diagnosis: teamwork, training, technology, and tuning. And these are broad strategies that I think could be applied to any problem, but I think they have to be implemented in a problem-specific way. So it's not enough to just say teamwork and then say, all right, well, engage nurses and engage patients around diagnosis. I think you have to get particular about it. In the same way that for catheter bloodstream infections, we got particular about putting nurses in the role of making sure that physicians were following sterile precautions when inserting the lines to decrease the rate of infections that resulted from unsterile insertions, I think we need to engage nurses to do the same thing. So in the emergency department, for instance, if it's a dizzy patient and the nurse sees that the physician has ordered a CAT scan, which is the common practice, they may say, well, look here, it says on the protocol that if you need a neuroimage, you have to get an MRI because the CAT scan misses 90% of the strokes. And you need to get an MRI, which at least picks up 80% of the strokes and only misses 20%. You know, would you like me to change it to an MRI? And oh, by the way, it also says you should look at the eye movements before you decide whether you need an MRI. Has anyone done that? Should I call a neurology consult for you to have someone look at the eyes? I think that kind of engagement around the teamwork piece of the puzzle is critical. And that can be done for any condition, but I think it has to be tailored to the specific problems in question. And we can focus on those 15 diseases that we highlighted as part of the Big Three study. On the training front, we have to do kind of the same thing. In a problem-specific way, we have to change the way we educate people. And there's been some great science done in medical education that sort of shows the way forward for how to do this. Unfortunately, we haven't found a way to implement that at a systematic level. What we've been doing is doing it specifically around dizziness and stroke, but it's something that could be applied to any condition. So we've recently done work that with a team here at Johns Hopkins of young educators who are taking work that we've done as part of our clinical trial where we've recorded each individual case, painstakingly recording eye movements, history findings, bedside exam in a digital form, and then transitioning them into a simulation-based kind of gaming tool to play with cases in a simulated environment. So what's sometimes called virtual patients. So you're interacting with real patients, but in a virtual environment that's safe. And what we showed is that just in 9 hours of simulation training, this is something that will be presented at this year's Diagnostic Error in Medicine Conference, we've shown that in just 9 hours of simulation training, we can take just graduated medicine interns and make them better at diagnosis by a factor of two than their graduating senior counterparts who are done with their training. So that's kind of the sort of technique that I see moving forward, this sort of simulation-based education to just get practice without harming patients in the process. The third front is this technology front. We've taken the approach of saying teamwork extends to this notion of technology. We can use, for example, around stroke, what we do is we take our video oculography goggles, and these are just essentially the equivalent of a pair of swim goggles with a special camera in it that connects to a computer. And essentially what it's doing is remotely measuring somebody's eye movements and recording them. We can ship those results, as we are doing as part of what we call our teledizzy consultation service, to the emergency room at Johns Hopkins. We can ship those results to somebody who's expert in interpreting eye movements. And in a matter of minutes, we can give sort of the thumbs up, thumbs down, your sort of green light, red light, kind of, this is a patient who needs a stroke workup, please admit them. This is a patient who can go home, send them to our clinic next week. Or here's the treatment, you know, do that and send them home. So that's where technology can come into play. And ultimately, that can be baked into decision support and artificial intelligence. We're not quite there yet, but we will eventually get there over the next couple of decades. Finally, I think the critical fourth ingredient is what we call tuning, which is this notion that We have to give people feedback. So far, we've really not done that. We talked about that a little earlier, that diagnostic errors are like bad breath. And so you know about everybody else's but not your own. Somehow we have to change that dynamic. We've been working on ways around stroke, but also in sepsis and heart attack, to use readily available administrative data about revisits to analyze the frequency of diagnostic errors. And we've shown that you can look at these large data sets and see the clear signal where there's an inappropriately high rate of people coming back after being sent home from the emergency department with a quote-unquote benign dizziness and coming back with stroke. Same thing. People with so-called benign chest pain coming back with heart attack. So-called people with benign fever or viral syndrome coming back with sepsis. And we can see that signal in the administrative data, and that allows us to have a method for operationally measuring and monitoring at the healthcare institution or emergency department kind of level how we're doing on our performance. And that ultimately is a bridge to getting us that calibration and feedback that we need.
Dr. Newman-Toker, the people who care the most, of course, are patients and their families. How can they help improve diagnostic accuracy? And I'm thinking now about the big ones, like stroke. Like, what are the warning signs that would suggest there is a problem? Heart attack, venous thromboembolism or pulmonary embolism. And then I'm thinking maybe sepsis or some of the cancers. So quickly give us some sense of what people can do, their families, to prevent this epidemic of diagnostic errors.
So certainly arming yourself with information in a general sense about the sort of 15 diseases that we've talked about that are part of the big three is a good thing to do. And there's obviously plenty of information available on the internet on many of these disorders. But I think there are three main things that, in general, patients can do related to their interaction with the healthcare system that can make a difference and hopefully reduce their chances of suffering a diagnostic error or becoming a statistic. And those three things, one is before they come to the encounter, one is during the encounter, and one is after the encounter. So before the encounter, they need to come prepared. So time is precious in an encounter with a physician in the healthcare system, whether it's in the emergency department, primary care, or elsewhere. There's a limited amount of time. So if patients can pre-prep a summary of their symptom or problem, something that's less than one page and sort of describes the timeline of their symptoms and problems, that can save the time that's required to gather all that information by a physician and turn it into thinking time for the doctor so that they can read that summary quickly and then start delving into, well, what might be causing the problem. The second thing is during the encounter, the patient has to ask good questions. And there are a couple of very important questions in particular. It's, what is the worst thing this could be? And why is it not that? And that's really the crux of the matter. If the physician or provider cannot give a cogent explanation of both what they might be worried about and why they think it's not that, or if they give a dismissive answer such as, oh, trust me, it's not that, I'm experienced, or if they get angry, you know, that you would even question, you need to find a new physician. Get another opinion, for sure. The third thing is after the encounter. Patients really need to stay vigilant after they've left the doctor. There's a common misconception among patients that if they're not getting better after they leave a doctor, it's because the treatment's not working. But sometimes the patient has the right treatment for the wrong disease. And that's what they have to remain vigilant about, because if you know that it's possible you might have the wrong diagnosis, you're more likely to re-enter the healthcare system and say, look, somebody told me I have this, but I'm not sure anymore because the treatment's not working. And I'm wondering whether, in fact, that's really what I have at all. Can you please rethink the situation? Otherwise, if they call up instead and say the treatment's not working, the doctor will just change the dose of the medicine, you know, and they could go weeks or months without getting to the right diagnosis. So those are, I think, three critical lessons that apply across all areas of medicine that patients should really take away as things that they should do in every healthcare encounter.
Dr. David Newman-Toker, thank you very much for talking with us on the People's Pharmacy today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Dr. David Newman Toker. He's director of the Johns Hopkins Armstrong Institute Center for Diagnostic Excellence and director of the Division of Neurovisual and Vestibular Disorders in the Department of Neurology. He's also professor of neurology at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine.
Lynn Siegel produced today's show. We had engineering from Al Wadarski and Jenny Lawson. Dave Graydon edits our interviews.
The People's Pharmacy is produced at the studios of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
The People's Pharmacy theme music is by B.J. Lederman.
The People's Pharmacy is brought to you in part by Verizana, an analytical laboratory providing home health tests for hormones, gut health, and the microbiome, online at verisana.com.
And by CocoVia, maker of high-potency cocoa flavanol supplements that support cognitive and cardiovascular health. More information at CocoVia.com.
To buy a CD of today's show or any other People's Pharmacy broadcast, you can call 800-732-2334. Today's show is 1186. That number again, 800-732-2334, online at peoplespharmacy.com.
When you visit our site, you'll find a link to Dr. Newman Toker's recent article in the journal Diagnosis. The title is Serious Misdiagnosis-Related Harms in Malpractice Claims, The Big Three, Vascular Events, Infections, and Cancers. You can also share your thoughts about today's show. Have you or a loved one experienced a misdiagnosis? How did the correct diagnosis come to light? Tell us about it.
At peoplespharmacy.com, you'll find our list of top 10 questions to ask to reduce diagnostic errors. In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. Thanks for listening. Please join us again next week.